is Notes from a Native Daughter. I am Sol Daniela. My guest today is the lovely and amazing Rosy Berrido, an actress, a writer, an acting and vocal coach, and all around creative. And I love creative people. I'm going to talk about life. Welcome, and thank you for being here with me.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, certainly.
Well, I have to ask you. We're gonna start from the very recent to, you know. We'll work ourselves back in time, okay. But I just found out something about you that I'm really fascinated by, and it's the fact that you do voiceovers for these books. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah.
What's that gig about? That's cool.
Yes, it is a very cool gig. I always joke about the fact that I don't need to even comb my hair or worry about what I wear when I show up for that job, which is my work. It's narrating audiobooks for the Library of Congress through a company that's based here in New York, and I narrate both fiction and nonfiction novels in English and Spanish.
And talk about some of the ones that you've read.
Some of my favorites are a really, really juicy one was The Mayan Prophecies by Maurice Cotterell. Talked about the Mayan calendar and all the details and the predictions of how the world was supposed to end. And I mean, some people say that it was an ending of sorts, you know, because we had so many changes on the planet and the climate changes and ecological changes and a lot of changes. Another one of my favorites is Las Moradas o el Castillo Interior, written by Santa Teresa de Jesús in 1965, a reflection and sort of a guide for the nuns preparing their soul to marry the Christ. And then I've had a lot of fun, others like The Darkest Hour, which was a sort of adventure novel, and a series of some of the Debbie McComber books, which are romantic, like sort of Harlequin novel types and paperbacks, and instructional books also. So all the themes are varied, books that go to the Congress.
And what do you learn from these things, from these experiences, literary experiences?
Oh, my goodness. Well, a lot of things. I mean, so from the Mayan prophecies, I learned about the Mayan calendar, and I learned about La Serpiente Emplumada. I learned about the goddess Quetzalcoatl. So I learned a lot of Aztec and Mayan culture from the Santa Teresa de Jesús, a lot of spiritual reflections, how even in Western philosophies and in Catholicism, we still find this sort of magic and mysticism in the number seven, because the premise of the book is that your soul interior is divided into seven compartments, and we always recognize, you know, the number seven is a lucky number, and we talk about having seven chakras and, you know, pressure points. And I can learn about cooking. I can learn about politics. I narrated En el País de las Mujeres, a beautiful book by a prize winner, winning writer, Gioconda Belli. And there I learned a lot about politics in South and Central America, because that's where the book is based. And it talks a lot about geography and things like that. So there's always something to be learned in the books. But the most important lesson that I learned is, I was narrating a book a couple of years ago, and I spoke to a very good friend of mine, Miriam, and I said to Miriam, the narration of this book is changing something inside of me. And she said, oh my God, that's wonderful. That means the person that will hear the book will also be changed. And I said, how do you mean? And she said, because whatever happens to the narrator along the way, any changes, any epiphanies, anything that affects the narrator will transcend in the audio and, you know, will reach whoever's listening, the receptor. And so that was a powerful lesson, to be present and to really be open to whatever it is that this text is responding to that I have going on at the moment, and that's going to transcend in the narration, and the listener is going to be affected by it, change for better or worse, hopefully for better.
So how proficient do you have to be able to read these books? I mean, it sounds very magnanimous, you know.
It is, thank you, yeah. It is and it isn't. I think it's that X factor. It's kind of, that ingredient that you need, sort of that inclination, like when they say, well, someone is born to do this, or someone is a natural, or you have a knack for this or a knack for that, because I didn't really go to school for any of it. I think you just have to be a good reader. Well, not just, I don't mean to, you know, sort of, you know, put it down by saying just, but most importantly, you obviously have to be a good reader, a clear reader. An important element is to be a dynamic, versatile narrator, which is what I was told that got me a very high qualification when I auditioned for the Congress. That yes, the reading was good, but it was also versatile, and that was quite a compliment. So I think bringing the acting experience into it also helps, because you can do, you know, characterizations. But certainly you do have to have a lot of breath control, be a good reader, have good diction, and then the rest just sort of happens. The book kind of walks you through the rhythm and the tone of the subject.
And how long does it take?
It depends on the book. Some books take 6 hours to narrate. If the calculation of the book is that the audiobook should be 6 hours, you might spend maybe 11 or 12 hours recording it. So of every 3 hours recorded, of every 3 hours that you work, you might end up with an hour and a half of recorded material, you know, once it's edited. So it depends on the novel. And it depends on, and I think sometimes it depends on the audience too, because if I do a narration that's for an educational video, then the rhythm is different, where we talk a little more robotic, because the person who's listening is learning a language. So it also depends on the subject.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And so when did you start this whole diction voiceover thing?
I started the coaching about 9 years ago. A friend of mine, or maybe longer, maybe just a little over a decade, a friend of mine, I was working at the Spanish Repertory at the time, full-time, and I was in 6 or 7 shows there, and a young actress came up to me and said, I love your work, and I love what you're doing, I have this audition, can you help me? And I said, sure, you know, what do you need help with? And she said, I need help a little bit with the pronunciation, and I want to prepare this monologue for this audition. So I helped her with the monologue, and she booked the job, and then she came back a month later, and she booked another job, and she recommended me to a few friends, and suddenly I was sharing my knowledge with some colleagues that had a little less experience and wanted to learn but didn't want to go back to sort of that orderly environment of a college or an acting, you know, course, which is more formal. And then throughout the years, people started coming back to me, and then I got referred to John Leguizamo to translate and adapt his Broadway show. And then we met, and we had great chemistry, and he said, you know, help me with the coaching. And so I helped him learn it, and I helped him with his diction in Spanish. And it's not something, I guess I prepared for it. My career, my work as an actor and as a voiceover artist and as a narrator prepared me for the coaching. And then I had a really bad car accident and stopped doing theater for a while, and then just did coaching. And so now I'm doing mostly coaching.
So, but let's go back to your coaching, acting, voiceover development. Like, how did you decide, or when, or in what state were you that you were like, hoy voy a ser voiceover artist?
Hoy voy a ser.
Voy a añadir.
Voy a añadir. No, vaya, no sé, no creo que llega como, a veces parece llegar como hoy decido, pero es un proceso. Y es algo en lo que vas entrando así poco a poco. Y la corriente de los eventos y de tu vida te va llevando allí. Pero primordialmente llegué allí por un accidente de carro que tuve, muy fuerte. 6 autos chocaron el West Side Highway, el mío fue impactado 4 veces, dio 4 vueltas y me hice mucho daño en el cuello, en la espalda. Y allí es cuando sé que físicamente ya no puedo volver al escenario. De momento subirme al escenario para hacer la coreografía y mover las cosas que tengo que mover. Entonces allí paso más tiempo en mi casa, eso me lleva a escribir y eso me lleva a entonces atender más las llamadas de los que quieren mi ayuda para hacer el coaching. Ayúdame con este acento, ayúdame con este monólogo. Y de repente, al ya sufrir el accidente, entonces y estar pasando tanto tiempo en mi casa, desempleada, entonces me meto en el mundo de lo que es el website y empiezo a crear mi website. Y a partir de ahí digo, ok, ya voy con esto, ahora me tiro de lleno, me tiro de pecho. Queda miedo, pero ahí me voy. Y aparte también ya llevaba un tiempo como impulsada un poquito hacia el servicio, esa intención de servir y de compartir las cosas que ya he aprendido en una carrera de 25 años y es lo que yo llamo the portion service of my life, or the service portion of my life rather. So now I'm, you know, here to just spread the word. And in the metaphysical sense, I think, you know, what you share expands. So as I teach and coach, I also learn a lot. So I continue to grow as an artist and a human being. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the long answer to when was that moment.
Yeah. Oh, no, I get it.
Yeah.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, well, thank you.
That's a really good answer. Yeah. And what about acting?
Acting, wow. When did I come to acting? I don't know that I made... I don't know. It's funny because I got asked once at an audition by an industry person, why do you act? And without a thought in my head, the spontaneous and very natural, just very extemporaneous, came out and I said, because I have no choice. I didn't even think about it. We always hear about, you know, the popular answers like, oh, I have stories to tell, or I want to change the world, or I want to, you know, bring this story or share my culture. But for me, it just, I had no choice. It was something that I needed to do, like, you know, breathing and just getting up and being an active part in the world and in society. And for me, it was a no-brainer. It was always there. I was on stage for the first time, I think, in fourth grade. I played Mrs. Claus. There's a picture right there, me and Santa Claus. My friend John was playing Santa Claus. I was playing Mrs. Claus. And that was the first time, and I loved it. I fell in love with it, and it was always part of me. And then as an adult, I saw on TV the Oklahoma bombing, and I was interning at an office, and I thought, no, I have to do what I feel I was kind of born to do. And yes, there was training, but the X factor has always been there, so, yeah.
What's the X factor?
I think the X factor is that sensitivity, the disposition to surrender to the creative process. What some people call talent, or some people call disposition, and so. But I think it's that need to surrender to the creative process, that something needs to be creative, and something needs to be creative and created and shared, whether it's through storytelling or singing or painting or interpreting a character. I think that's really the X factor, that you have the impulse, that it really is, and it's picking at every fiber of your being until you do it. And that's what some people also call passion, you know, the voice, the vocación in Spanish. The etymology of vocación is voz, the voice comes from voz, y care, from the heart. So it's a voice, it's this little whisper in your heart that says, you have to do this. And so there comes the passion. And if you have the knack and the ability, you know, physically to do it, if there's no physical impediment, you know, then it's kind of an easy ride. So I think those are some of the key elements that sort of play into that X factor.
Sure. Makes me think it's deep.
Yeah. It is. Yes and no. I think that through my spiritual practices, I've found that a lot of the things that we tend to give so much weight to and put all these labels to and attach all these ideas and concepts to are not as sometimes heavy or dense as we think they are. So in essence, and not to take, you know, like 300 or 3,000 years of philosophy, but I've come to learn personally and professionally and creatively that it's not as heavy as we think it is. And so we have to take things lighter and take so many more things in stride and not take it as personal. Know that we're just part of the flow. And yeah, it's deep, but it doesn't have to be a heavy burden. And that's kind of like the paradox, kind of like the dichotomy of, I think, in a way, successful living, I'm going to dare to say, to be serious about it, to know that it's serious but not take it serious, is kind of the one of the keys, I think. Yeah.
You spoke about the car accident, but you... But you mentioned it in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And this is a fully bilingual podcast, by the way.
Wow, thank you.
But I want I want people to know that story. More people will understand you in English. Mm-hmm. Because I want you to go a little bit into how you sort of found this other self.
Mm-hmm.
Through that near-death experience, and then how your movie comes to sort of reflect in a strange way everything that you went through this character.
It's funny because I had that funny, not ha-ha funny, well, sometimes ha-ha funny, but mostly ironic funny. When things have sort of marked or scheduled, I guess on a divine providence, you know, invisible level, I had been wishing to spend a little more time at home and a little more time to write. And then I had this accident, my sixth car accident, and my car flipped around a couple times. And in the middle of it, my mother and I, we actually were convinced in the moment that we were heading towards the water. And then a fourth car T-boned us, and that's where the accident kind of ended. And that led me to spend a lot of months at home, unemployed, and it led me to start thinking about what are the things that I can do if I'm not going to spend as much time on stage anymore. And that brought me back to the coaching. And that's where I began to look at some manuscripts and things that I had written, monologues that I had written in college and stuff like that, and look at some short film scripts that I had written. And then I see this great documentary called How to Die in Oregon, about dying with dignity. And it brought me back to the thoughts about when I lived with my grandmother and how she, you know, was ready to go and would sort of tell all of us, I'm ready to go, you know, I'm ready to go, I've had it. And I also thought about my great-grandmother, who actually had practiced dying with dignity, or did practice dying with dignity. She was 104, and she decided that she was ready to go. So she said to the woman that took care of her, "Don't feed me." And she locked herself up in a room, and within 2 weeks, she was dead. And that's a sort of category of dying with dignity. And so I decided to write a trilogy about that subject. And... that's how, and so the accident, I think, I don't know another word for accident, but it's an event that needs to happen when you're ready for a change, to move to another level. Sometimes it's easy for us to take responsibility and say, I'm going to change this, I'm going to move to my next level, I'm going to continue on my evolution, or sometimes the universe will force us into it. You know, and then we're jarred into this change, and to see if we really want what we say we want. And there I come up with all these rules. And so that's how I birth Rosie's Rules, my coaching services, based on, you know, this dark episode in my life. And these sort of rules and this service and this coaching stuff is ready to be born. And so I finally go for it. It's quite scary at times, but I love it. I really do love it. My heart just beams when I see an actor understand what I'm trying to say, and I help them, you know, improve a monologue or improve the technique, or just reassure them that they're not alone and that we're sharing the accountability, and that's really lovely. Yeah.
What are the rules?
The rules, wow. Well, there are 100 rules.
Oh my God, 100 rules.
100, yeah.
Can you give me 10, the top 10?
Yes, well, first I'll tell you how they're divided. The 100 rules, they're divided into 4 categories. The first category speaks specifically to the craft of acting. So the 25 that speak specifically to craft of acting can be applied practical tools and principles for your craft. The second category or division speaks to communications, human relations. The third speaks to ethics, professional ethics, personal ethics. And the fourth category speaks to spirituality. And the reason why they ended up being divided like that is because every time I came up with I'm calling them rules, but, you know, they're guidelines, they're tips, they're sort of markers.
Yeah, but rules is fun. You got to have
exactly.
A
little humor. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and people turn it into Rosie Rules. And sometimes it's, sometimes I rule.
It's
sometimes,
your thing, Rosie's Rules.
Sometimes they're my rules,
Rosie,
and sometimes
category.
I rule, yeah.
Why is that? I'm game. I totally get it. It's fine.
So, yeah, so the categories... And the approach is, and I came to understand that the approach needs to be holistic. So body, mind, and spirit are connected. And so if you have these little markers and have these rules that you follow in different areas of your life, spiritually, in communication, physically, personal, spiritually, intellectually, you know, all these things. So once these areas are taken care of, you can become a better, well-rounded person and a more well-rounded actor. Because obviously our personal life informs our work, and then our work informs our personal life. And so the healthier we are, the more present we are, the more open we are. I don't believe in that, you know, that you're an actress and you have to be all eccentric and be high or be drunk or be crazy to be a riveting creator. No. I think you should be healthy. You should be well taken care of. You need to be well informed. And so those are my rules. And some of the rules are, for example, I've given them fun names. Like one of my favorites is Undo Your Do. And then I explain it. Don't be afraid to undo tongue patterns of tongue, to undo patterns of tongue placement. If you have a Spanish tongue, you pull it up and back for a standard American T. So the idea is that if you're willing to undo your do, to relax and let your hair down, and you're Hispanic, that would normally say Tony, which is a T in Spanish where the tongue moves forward.
Tony.
Now you want to say Tony in English. The Tony, you pull it up and back, and you hit the gum ridge, and now it's a Tony.
Right.
Instead of Tony, you are Tony.
Yeah. I'm fully bilingual, though. I know that one.
There you go. Yeah, so, but you...
Okay, give me an exercise. Exactly. I want to practice. Give me a poem.
Yeah, so I don't know. Well, if you want to do, I don't know, are you trying to fix English or Spanish?
Neither.
Well, let's say, for someone who's trying to fix English... Let's say, if they're Hispanic and they have a slight accent in English, then a good tongue twister might be Peter Piper.
Okay.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers. A peck of pickled peppers did Peter Piper the pickled pepper pick a pick. Now, if Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, where is the peck of pickled peppers that Peter Piper the pickled pepper picker picked?
I gotta learn that one.
Well,
all I know is Peter Piper picked a peck of pickles?
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
What
is it?
There.
Say it again.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
There you go. Perfect. So that's if someone wants to improve English. If someone wants to improve Spanish,
go ahead.
Then we go to maybe el arzobispo de Constantinopla. El arzobispo de Constantinopla se quiere desarzobispo constantinopolizar. Y el desarzobispo constantinopolizador que lo desarzobispo constantinopolice, buen desarzobispo constantinopolizador será. So.
Primera parte.
Ya. Primera parte es el arzobispo de Constantinopla se quiere desarzobispo constantinopolizar.
El arzobispo de Constantinopla
se quiere
desarzobispo
constantinopolizar.
Desarzobispo
constantinopolizar. Constantinopolizar. Desarzobispo constantinopolizar.
Desarzobispo descontabilizar.
Wow! We'll talk later. So, see? So the point is, and then you have things like, you know.
Pero una cosa, do you have that in a little claro, sheet of paper that you can read? Because I'm just like, yo estoy aquí
con... Of course, blood. Claro, claro.
Es el coño.
Claro, está en papel y bueno, entonces... Y todo
y, ese... y tú te sabes, el cielo está en cancara nublado, que lo en cancara nubló, el que lo en cancara nubló... No, el cielo está encancaranublado. ¿Quién lo encancaranublaría? El encancaranublado, tremendo encancaranublador
no.
sería.
¡Oh, Dios mío! No, es hace años que no lo escuchaba. No, el favorito de John Leguizamo era una cacatrepa. Una cacatrepa tenía cuatro cacatrepitos y cuando la cacatrepa trepaba, trepaban los cacatrepitos.
Good.
And he
Rosie loved rules. So that's Rosie why they say Rosie rules, because it's like, that shit is good, yeah. Okay, can you say it again?
So, de la cacatrepa. Una cacatrepa tenía cuatro cacatrepitos. Y cuando la cacatrepa trepaba, trepaban los cacatrepitos.
Wow. Una cacatrepitos.
Una cacatrepa.
Suena muy lindo.
Claro, claro. Entonces está María Chucena. ¿Por quién te echas la choza de María Chucena? Y hay, y así hay un...
Di ese.
El de María Chucena. Un hombre pasaba y preguntó a María Chucena... María Chucena, ¿de quién te echas la choza? Y María Chucena contesta, ni la mía ni la tuya, te echo la choza de María Chucena. Se me olvida en este momento, pero es muy bonito. Y es muy español y muy famoso. La choza de María Chucena. María Chucena te echaba su choza. Y Sansón no sazona su salsa con sal, la salsa le sale sosa.
Si Sansón no sazona su salsa con sal.
Su salsa sale sosa.
Esa me la voy a aprender. Esa no es tan,
la sucesión,
tan difícil.
La sucesión sucesiva de sucesos sucede sucesivamente con la sucesión del tiempo. La sucesión sucesiva de sucesos sucede sucesivamente con la sucesión del tiempo.
Eso está buenísimo.
Ay, ese está bueno. Ese me encanta.
Una vez yo estaba en una obra, perdona que te interrumpa, pero... Yo hice un error que yo todavía me río con el libreto.
Oh, no.
Y tenía que ver con esto mismo, que a lo mejor si hubiese hecho los ejercicios antes, porque esta era, ya era hacia el final de la obra, que uno pues uno se cansa, ¿verdad? Uno está todo el tiempo, y en esta obra se llamaba San Miguel, amarra tu perro. Yo tenía que declamar cartas de estos grandes próceres puertorriqueños. Entonces había una que era de Ramón Emeterio Betances a Eugenio María de Hostos, y entonces él decía, nos empeñamos en ensanchar la sociedad a Cabo Rojo.
Okay.
Esa era la oración.
Okay.
Y yo salgo y digo, nos empeñamos en ensanchar la sociedad como eso.
¡No me
salió nada!
No.
Y yo me acuerdo que estaban los músicos... Cuando yo miré, estaban así, porque se querían reír, porque yo súper seria, yo in character.
Qué cómico,
of course. Nos empeñamos en...
Dios mío.
That coaching, like you would have been like, yes. Oh my God.
But I would have been suffering. Yeah. I would have been suffering. Yeah. I recently had an interview and I was talking about John and I said, we performed it. And she said, I love how you took ownership. And I said, of course, because while the actor is on stage, the coach is behind a curtain sweating bullets.
Yeah. Exactly.
Y es como, o sea, igual, pero vaya. Y esa es la magia de teatro en vivo, de que cuando pasan esas cosas dices, oh no, que también es una de las reglas, one of Rosie's rules is
what?
Be prepared with a little improv.
Be
prepared with a little improv, because when you are in the spotlight, you can't say, oh shit, what now? I mean, it's actually a rule. And so it reminds the actor to brush up on improv, because anything could happen. Anything could happen on stage, and you really just have to plow through and keep going.
Isn't that how life is?
Of course, yeah. I guess that's the kicker. That's the beauty and the challenge. So how we meet those challenges is
how we face them.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
In the improv of life,
yeah.
In a sense, right?
Of course,
it's an improv class.
And who has the crystal ball, really? And no rehearsal. I mean, they tell us all the time, no rehearsal. But we somehow don't seem to get it. You know, it's difficult. When we're in the throes of it, it's difficult.
Yeah. So, you're gracious, you're grateful.
Thank you. Absolutely. Yes. Oh, God, yes. I believe in God. I believe in, you know, there's a source. I believe in the source. We want to call it, you know, sometimes divine providence or God. I am, and especially once I really understood that none of that belongs to me, it really just comes through me. And so in concepts like, you know, understanding to stay healthy and be open and in a state of surrender really is what helps that channel be even more, you know, in the light and more connected to the source, so that all the stuff that has to come through me will come, you know, with humility and with grace. I mean, really, that's all I could do, because I'm not in control. So, yeah. So certainly, great. Trying to always be gracious, and certainly always very grateful.
That's beautiful. So follow Rosie's rules.
Thank you. Yeah.